Why Israel? Was presented by Rusty Rexius on February 21, 2016 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2016. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
So, I have three quotes. They're very, very important quotes, and you need to hear them before I started. One is by a great theologian, Willy Wonka, who said, "So much time, so little to do." The next two are my favorite, from a wise little man. Some people call him Yoda. Yoda said, "You must unlearn what you've learned." And I won't do my Yoda voice, although I have one. And the other one is, "Many of the truths we cling to depend on our point of view." I love that one because I've found as I've gotten older, that's absolutely true. What I think is true depends on my point of view. Jack asked me to talk about something that I was passionate about and that I would have fun with. And I was in a meeting one time. I was on a commission for the city, and I was listening to these people talk about things, and they were clearly incredibly passionate about what they were arguing about. And I left the meeting, and I actually went home, and I told Susie, you know, I can't really figure out what I'm passionate about because it's not what they were talking about. And then it dawned on me, I'm passionate about at least three things. I'm passionate about recklessly pursuing what's true. That has gotten me into trouble from time to time, but I am passionate about that. And that's typically what I would talk about if asked. I'm passionate about my family, for sure. And the third thing I'm passionate about is Israel. That's what I'm passionate about. And over the years, which has been some time now, I've started and oftentimes asked my question, why? Why am I passionate about Israel? So what I want to talk about today, actually, ironically, Adam and I and Nikki did not plan this, but he was talking about his trip, maybe life coming up in Israel, and I have been thinking about for some time, I don't know what to call it, why Israel is what came to my head, but there are 10 reasons why I think we should care about Israel today. 10 reasons why Israel matters. Some of them are not particularly shocking. I don't think you'll find them all that revolutionary. In fact, I don't know that you'll find any of this all that revolutionary, but this is important to me. This matters to me as I've thought through, and I've been asked, and I'll talk a little bit about this later, why? Why do you care about Israel? Why does it matter? Why do you obsess about this place over several thousand miles away? So I'm going to answer that question today for me. If that's helpful for you, I hope it is. I think it's relevant information. I think it's information that matters. But again, I don't know that it's going to break any particularly new ground, and I'm not convinced it'll change your life, but maybe I'll be surprised. I grew up in a church like probably most of you did. I was very much a church kid and learned all the things that church kids learn. Some of the men and women, but mostly men in this case, that were influential in the way I thought, some of the names you've heard of before, Chuck Swindoll. I remember when we would go on trips, our parents would put in those cursed Chuck Swindoll tapes as we were traveling, or in fact, my sister-in-law is here as well, and there was many years when we went to vacation at Lake Shasta on houseboats, and every day we listened to Chuck Swindoll tapes. Ray Stedman was another one, which that name gets dropped around a lot here. Ray Stedman was very instrumental in a church that my family started, and we were in for many, many years, and lots of what Ray said was what I believed. And then I was one of the folks who was part of what's called the Cape and Ray Bible Torchbearer Missionary Fellowship Group, and so I went to Cape and Ray. There are others around that did, and I got taught by some, I think, some amazing people. I don't necessarily think they taught me well, particularly, but I became very embedded in the whole Keswick theology, the let go and let God thing that you've heard around here sometime. That's how I grew up. I remember vividly at Bible school one time when the director of the school actually said, we were studying Romans, and he said, anytime you see the word Israel, you should replace it with church. And for several decades, actually, that's how I rolled. I just assumed that when the Bible spoke of Israel in the New Testament, that what the Bible was speaking about was the church. In other words, Israel had literally gone by the wayside and the church had taken its place. You have probably all heard that. I hope none of you believe that, but that's what I heard. Well, for a long time, actually for a very long time. I'm not going to take you through the whole odyssey of my life, but Susie and I were gone for a while and then came and back and began to live in Eugene again, and we made the crucial error of starting to go hang out at the McKinsey Study Center, and in particular, Tuesday nights, and made the fatal mistake of listening to Jack talk about Romans. I think that was, 17 or 18? I think he's on 35 or 36 now, something like that. Three things happened for Susie and I both, when we came out of that. I became convinced of the sovereignty of God. I hadn't had that conviction before that. I became convinced that the Bible is an ongoing story. It's not a story done. It's a story still very much in play. And that story includes the Jewish people. And it includes me, but it absolutely includes the Jewish people. That was different to me. I'd never really thought about that before. As we muddled through our thinking and changed our minds about virtually everything, I came to four conclusions that have led me to where I will eventually get today and what I think about Israel. Number one, God has, is, and will do what he intends to do. There's no changing that. That's no surprise to you. He has, he is, and he will tell a story. That's his point. It's his story, and he's going to tell it. Utterly central to that story is Israel. Israel and its people, the Jews. And fourth, Jesus is the apex. There's no doubt about it. He's the apex of the story. But he is so in the context as a Jewish Messiah, in a Jewish story, in a Jewish place, with a Jewish ending. I hope everybody, have come to understand that to make any sense of what all that means, you have to understand the Jewish context of the Bible. And I think there's some sense in which we all know that. You have to go into the Jewish world, into the Jewish mind, and into the Jewish land in order to completely understand what the Bible is saying. But I've taken it a step further. And what has dawned on me in the last several years, and what has become apparent to me as I've thought about what I believe, is it isn't just recognizing the Jewish content or the Jewish context in a historic time. It actually is about understanding the Jewish Israel today. That is impacting my theology. That is impacting how I understand the Bible. That is actually impacting what it is that I believe. I'm not confused. I know that the Bible is primarily and principally about God changing hearts, and that ultimately, when it's all said and done, that's what matters. I'm not going to stand before God and try to give the Jewish context of my belief. I'm going to stand before God and he will expose my heart. And I'll have to answer to that. And I hope that I'll have an advocate there for me to answer for that. But what I've come to believe is that in the process of that changing of my heart, that thing that is going on and will always go on, part of that event in my life is part and parcel to me figuring out what it is and what my relationship is to the Jewish people in the land in which they live. It seems to me those things are tied together. That's new for me. I'd never thought about that before. So the primary message of the Bible, I realize, is man's rebellion against God and what God has come to do about that. But I believe that that also includes coming to a clarity about how it is that within the Jewish context, that's going to happen. As I've come to think that's the case, and that's what I believe, I thought of four occasions where I've gotten pushback on that. And I don't go into very many of them, but it's interesting to me that as I try to articulate, actually talk through with people why it is that I'm obsessed with this place and these people, some of them look at me like I've actually lost my mind. I was on a business trip with a fellow that I respect a great deal. I still work with him. We were in the car and we were headed up the road for a while, and we were talking about, I don't even remember what the subject was, but I made the comment that it was important to me to understand and to figure out what it was, the role that the Jewish people were playing in the story that God was telling. And he turned and he looked at me and he says, "What possible difference could that make? What possible difference could it make? What matters with the Jews? It isn't about the Jews anymore." Sadly, I was in an elders meeting at another church. And one of the other guys and I, he had just been to Israel and I was going to Israel. And we were talking about it, and I get very animated about it. I'm told that I actually begin to start yelling when I start talking about this stuff. I'll try not to do that today, but I was pumped. I was excited. And we were talking at the time, Joel Rosenberg was the guy who's an author. He writes about end times, and he was talking about some stuff in Ezekiel. And this man and I were talking about it, this other elder and I, and I was getting all worked up and excited. And one of the other gentlemen there, he didn't care at all. Just wasn't interesting. And I looked at him and I said, "Why aren't you excited?" And he said, "I don't really think about it." I don't really think about Israel. I don't really think about the Jewish people, which was stunning to me. I was very surprised by that. And then there are some here who have been a part of this, but in my own personal pursuit, as I'm studying the Bible and have spent a great deal of time teaching it, it is inevitable that I end up talking about the Jewish people in the land in which they live, then and now. And honestly, in some cases, there is such a pushback that there's almost a palpable anger. Like, stop talking about that. Stop it. Just talk about something else. Just quit talking about Israel, would you? Very interesting, very puzzling to me. And then last but not least, as we have, many of you know this, as we have begun to engage in the Messianic community within Gutenberg and elsewhere, I can't tell you how many people look at me with this just glazed over look. Like, how could that possibly matter? How could that even matter? So as I've faced into those questions, and there are others, that resistance and there is more, I started to ask myself just a series of questions. Why spend all this time diving into the Jewish context of the Bible? Why take the time to understand what has happened over the last 2,000 years with the Jewish people? Why get so worked up over what's happening over in Israel right there today? Why do I read about the War of Independence, the Six-Day War, the Yom Kippur War, and the countless other military actions that have happened over the last 100 years? Why in the world is my favorite book, a book called Prime Ministers, the story of Levi Eskol, Golda Meir, Yitzhak Rabin, and Menachem Begin? That's my favorite book in the whole world. Why? Why do I care about this stuff? And then why am I so upset when our own president is demanding that Israel get back what is rightfully theirs? Those infamous 1967 lines that you've all heard about. Well, and last and not least, why am I so obsessed that I'm about to take my third trip there in a couple of months, and I know it won't be enough. I know it won't be enough. I'll want to go again and again and again. So those are the questions. And I have decided to do my best at articulating from a biblical perspective why I think Israel matters. I know that you're supposed to leave the crescendo, sort of the ta-da at the end, but I'm going to give it to you at the very beginning. Ultimately, what has convinced me that I'm right about this stuff is actually Romans chapters 9, 10, and 11. I'm not going to read them all. I am going to read a ton of scripture today, and I apologize for that, but I don't know how else to do this. But Romans 9, 10, and 11, I'm actually in the middle of translating it now for my third time right now, and I'm just convinced. There are other ways to take it, I know, and arguments can be made for an alternative rendering, but my belief is that, and we'll read some of these passages that I will hopefully help you see what I'm talking about, that the story that God is telling, he is clearly telling it with the Jewish people in mind, and there is absolutely a sense in which the Gentiles, me, have been included in that. But the point of me being included is for the benefit of the Jews, that is why God has included me into the story. There are those that disagree with that. As I said, there are some in the technical term is replacement theology or supersessionism, but the conviction of those folks is that the Jewish people have been left behind and the Gentiles have been put in his place. I think that's wrong. I think that the Jewish people and the Jewish story is the point and the reason that God is telling the story. With respect to my question today, why Israel, I think this outlines fairly succinctly how it is and why it is that Israel matters today. Romans 9:4, he says, and I'm not going to go through all these passages. I'd be happy to do that sometime. It's my favorite passage in the Bible. But Romans 9:4, who all are all Israelites, to them belong the adoption as the sons, the glory, the covenants, the giving of the law, the temple worship, the promises. To them belong the patriarchs, and from them, by human descent, came the Christ, who is God over all, blessed forever. Amen. These next ones are from Romans 11, verse 1. So I ask, this is the chronology that I believe takes us through why Israel matters today. God has not rejected his people, has he? Absolutely not. For I too, and Paul speaking, I too am an Israelite, a descendant of Abraham from the tribe of Benjamin. Verse 11, I ask then why they did not stumble into an irrevocable fall, did they? Absolutely not. But by their transgression, salvation has come to the Gentiles to make the Jews jealous. Verse 17, now if some of the branches were broken off, the Jews, and you, the Gentiles, a wild olive shoot, were grafted in among them and participated in the richness of the olive tree, verse 19, then you will say the branches were broken off so that I can be grafted in. Paul says in verse 20, granted they were broken off because of their unbelief, but you stand in faith. Don't be arrogant, but fear, verse 23. And even they, if they do not continue in their unbelief, they will be grafted in, for God is able to graft them in again. Verse 25, "For I do not want you to be ignorant of this mystery, brothers and sisters, so that you may not be conceited. A partial hardening has happened to Israel until the fullness of the number of the Gentiles comes in." Verse 26, "And so all Israel will be saved. As it is written, the deliverer will come from Zion. He will remove ungodliness from Jacob. And last, for the gifts and the call of God are irrevocable." So without taking any time to try to defend any of that, and again, I'd be happy to do that sometime, but I conclude from this passage that whatever it is that Israel has been promised, I have been included in that promise. And that in order that God may achieve his purposes, he's actually going to use me in concluding and bringing through and bringing to pass those promises. And if that's true, if I have been included, if I am a part of the promises, then it seems to me that it makes sense to know what those promises are. That it makes a lot of sense for me to dive in and figure out if I'm right, if what has been promised to the Jewish people is also promised to me, then I probably ought to figure out what those promises are. So that's what we're going to do. We've got four covenants to look at and then some other notes. I'm going to read a ton of passages. Hopefully this makes sense. The things that I would like you to pay attention to, the things that I would like you to hone in on, notice how often in the Abrahamic covenant, the Mosaic covenant, the Davidic covenant, and even the New Covenant, notice how often the term forever is used. Notice how often the term eternity or eternal is used. Notice how much it sounds like much of what Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, Moses, David, and then when we read in Jeremiah in the New Covenant, notice how much it sure looks like what he is saying. Some of it has happened and much of it has not. And I also want you to notice in all of this how many times and how many places everything is Israel-centered. Everything is Israel-centered. And then you can ask yourself the question, well, should I be paying attention over there right now? If that's where all this stuff is pointing, should I be paying attention there now? So the Abrahamic covenant, you all are very familiar with that, I know. You'll find it in Genesis. It's restated many times. I won't read every single time it comes up, but Genesis 12:1, "Now the Lord said to Abram, go forth from your country, from your relatives, and from your father's house to the land which I will show you. And I will make you a great nation. I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse the ones who curse you. And on all the families of the earth you shall be blessed." Later in Genesis, this is in chapter 13, "The Lord said to Abraham, after Lot had separated from them, now go," and this is where I want you to start to pay close attention to the literal, real, tangible stuff that Abraham was asked to look at. "Lift up your eyes and go and look from the place where you are." They were probably in the Negev desert. "Look north and south and east and west for all the land which you see, and I will give it to you and to your descendants forever. And I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your descendants can also be numbered. Arise, walk through the land, through its length and its breadth, for I will give it to you." I don't know if you've thought about this. And if you've not been in Israel, then, well, even if you have been in Israel, I mean, I don't know exactly what Abraham was seeing, but it sure looks like if you're standing there, what God is saying is, Abraham, have a look. Look all the way down to Egypt. Look all the way up to Lebanon. Look all the way out into the Mediterranean Sea and look all the way over to Iraq. It's all yours. It's all yours. I'm giving all of it to you. Genesis 15, "On the day that the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, to your descendants I have given this land." Here we go again. "From the river of Egypt," that's probably not the Nile, but a wadi that separates the Sinai from Egypt, "as far as the great river Euphrates," that's the one in Iraq. He goes through the ites that he's going to take out in the land of Canaan. He says, "I'm giving all of this to you." Now again, there's a case that can be made that there can be some alterations to this, I suppose, but God is pretty clear here. Have a look, Abraham. You're standing somewhere in the southern part of the country. There's a river right there. That's one border. There's a river up there. That's a long ways away in Iraq. That's another. The sea on one side, and the north, it's debatable how far up that goes. But God is saying that all that is his. Genesis 17, "And I will establish my everlasting covenant between you and your descendants after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your descendants after you. And I will give to you and to your descendants after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God." So I just want to remind you that if I'm right about the Romans passage, if Paul really is suggesting that our promises as a Gentile people are hooked part and parcel to those of the Jews, this is what we're talking about, and it is the land that's over there right there today. I'll get to this later, but I believe that's where we're all going to be camped out for probably all of eternity. So it just makes sense to me that it ought to matter what's happening there right now. I'm not going to read any of the rest of them, but God confirms the same stuff over and over again to Isaac and to Jacob and again to the 12 tribes of Israel. So that's number one, the Abrahamic covenant. Number two, the Mosaic covenant. I think the Mosaic covenant is primarily about the way that the Jews are to live in the land. I don't want to make the case that we're supposed to be law-keeping Gentiles necessarily. And I don't actually know about that, but that's not my point today. But the covenant is for the way that the Jewish people, the Mosaic covenant, were to live in the land. But God goes over and over again much of the same stuff that he does in the Abrahamic covenant. And it's very clear, at least to me, that this, again, is not just for that people for just that time, but it is forever and for eternity in a literal, physical, tangible place, which today is called Israel. It seems that there's two kinds of ways in which God speaks to the folks. There is some stuff that they are to do right now, the laws that they are to keep right now, and a certain set of things will happen right now. But there's also a set of things that he says, if you'll do, this will be forever, which is very much like the Abrahamic covenant. I recognize, I'm not confused, that it's not as if I was standing there. I don't think that I should pretend that I was one of the children of Israel and God was speaking to me just like he was speaking to them. But if I'm right about Paul in the Romans passage, in the way that the promises were made to those people, if I have been grafted in, these are my promises as well, I ought to pay attention to them. I ought to know something about what he says to them. So there are several in Exodus. I will read some of them. Exodus, go to 23. Behold, I am going to send an angel before you to guard you along the way and bring you into the place which I have prepared. Be on your guard before him and obey his voice and do not be rebellious towards him, for he will not pardon your transgression since my name is in him. But if you truly will obey his voice and do all that I say, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. For my angel will go before you and bring you into the land and destroy all the ites, and I will completely destroy them. And you shall not worship their gods, nor serve them, nor do according to their deeds, but you shall utterly overthrow them and break their sacred pillars in their pieces. But you shall serve the Lord your God, and he will, this is what's interesting, he will bless your bread, he will bless your water, I will remove sickness from your midst. There will be no one miscarrying barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days, and I will send my terror ahead of you and throw into confusion all the people among whom you have come. And I will make them all your enemies and turn their backs to you. And I will send hornets ahead of you that they may drive out the ites. I will not drive them out before you in a single year that the land may not become desolate and the beasts of the field become so numerous for you. I will drive them out before you little by little until you become fruitful and take possession of the land. Notice the boundaries again, verse 31. And I will fix your boundary from the Red Sea, it's all the way at the bottom, to the Sea of the Philistines, which is all the way up. If you're standing in Israel looking up, if you're at the bottom at the Red Sea, you're down below this, basically at the bottom of the Sinai Peninsula. And he's saying, I'm fixing your boundary from here all the way up to the Sea of the Philistines. That's the Mediterranean Sea. From the wilderness, probably down over here to the right or to the left, could be either one, all the way up to the river Euphrates. So he basically drew, and I think he drew an X here, and he's saying from all the way down here to all the way up here to all the way down here to all the way up there, the entire land of Israel, that's what I'm going to deliver to the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and I will drive them out before you. You shall make no covenant with them or their gods. They shall not live in your land, lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare for you. A couple of more passages, again, to highlight the forever and eternity. Deuteronomy 5:29, oh, that they had such a heart in them that they would fear me and keep all of my commandments always, that it may be well with them and with their sons forever. Deuteronomy 7, again, then it shall come about, because you listen to these judgments and you keep them and do them, the Lord your God will keep with you his covenant. And he will love you, and he will bless you, and he will multiply you, and he will bless the fruit of your womb and the fruit of the ground, your grain and your new wine and the oil and the increase of your herd and all the young of your flock and the land which he swore to your fathers to give you. You shall be blessed above all people. He goes on to describe this existence that I don't think ever happened yet. He said, "You shall be blessed above all the peoples. There shall be no male or female barren among you or among your cattle. And the Lord will remove from you all sickness, and he will not put on you any kind of harmful disease." He goes on to talk about some more of that. Point here, and I've got way more of these verses to read, but I think I'm just going to leave it at that, that in very much in the same way that God made the promises that he did to Abraham, which clearly are promises that have yet to occur and fulfillment that is yet to have happened, the same sort of thing is happening in Exodus in the Mosaic Covenant. It's even a little more specific. It's even more tangible and real with respect to how it is that these people, us, are going to live in this land that he's given them. And he makes no mistake. He makes no mistake about where the boundaries and the borders are. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that because I'm not exactly sure what to do with that now. We'll talk a little bit. I'm sure all of you know what those boundaries are today, and they're not what I just described. I don't know exactly what to do with that. But my point here is that God in the Mosaic Covenant is making promises that have yet to be fulfilled, that if they are to the Jewish people and I have been grafted in, those are my promises. Well, I ought to be paying attention over there. The Davidic Covenant. This is a very familiar covenant to all of you, and I will only read a little bit of it just to remind you of what it speaks. 2 Samuel, "Now therefore, thus you shall say to my servant David, thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from the pasture, from the following of the sheep, that you should be rule over my people, Israel. And I have been with you wherever you have gone and have cut off all your enemies before you, and I will make you a great name, like the name of the great men who are on the earth. I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and I will plant them, that they may live there in their own place, and they shall not be disturbed again. Nor will the wicked afflict them any more as formerly, even from the day that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel, and I will give you the rest from all your enemies. The Lord also declares that the Lord will make a house for you." And then the familiar passage, "When your days are complete and when you will lie down with your fathers, I will raise up for your descendant after you who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom." Here we go again with the forevers and the eternities. "He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men and the strokes and the sons of men. But my loving kindness shall not depart from him, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed it before you. And your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever." I don't know how many of you know, this is said again in Jeremiah, similar sort of language. "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will fulfill the good word which I have spoken concerning the house of Israel and the house of Judah." Notice the two sides of the equation there, Israel and Judah. "In those days and at that time I will cause a righteous branch of David to spring forth, and he shall execute justice and righteousness on earth. And in those days Judah shall be saved, and Jerusalem shall dwell in safety. And this is the name by which she shall be called, the Lord is our righteousness. For thus says the Lord, David shall never lack a man to sit on the throne of the house of Israel." All that's very familiar to us, and I think I immediately go to how it is that, well, who it is and how it is that is going to fulfill that role as the eternal king, and we all know that's Jesus. I don't think there's much debate about that. But what dawns on me is that if that's coming, one, if I'm a part of the promises, if I'm a part of the covenants, and I think I am, then when the king comes to sit on the throne of David forever, that's Jesus. I'm going to argue that's in Jerusalem. I'm going to argue that's on Temple Mount. I'm going to argue that's in a temple that hasn't been built yet. But if all of that's going to happen and he's going to be my king, I probably ought to know something about kings because I've never had one before. And it would be interesting to know how it works in Israel, in the minds of Israel, how it is that a king will reign and rule over people. That's not something I'm familiar with at all. I had the most fascinating conversation. I hadn't even thought about this until just now. When we were in Israel the first time, our guide, who many of you know, Abraham, got tired of me arguing with him and asking him 1,000 questions to which I would never let him answer because I'd had another question to ask. So he had a friend of his. His name was Mark. Not that that matters. It happened to be a guy named Mark. And we were at Hebrew University having lunch. And Abraham, this guy was a professor, now that I think about it, at Hebrew University. And Abraham got this grin on his face. And he drugged me over to Mark. We were in a cafeteria. And he sat me down. He said, "Mark, meet Rusty. Rusty, meet Mark. Have at it." And there he left us talking, and it was a fascinating conversation. It was a political conversation, which I promised to myself I wouldn't talk politics today. I'm not going to be able to quite get away with that one. But anyway, I was talking with Mark, and we were talking about political systems and all, and arguing which one was the best, and we just weren't going to agree. And I said, well, tell you what, you tell me, what's the perfect political system? And he thought for a long time. This guy was an atheist. He had absolutely no interest in God or anything about God. And he said, well, the obvious answer to that is it'd be a king. And I kind of paused. I thought that was a funny thing for him to say. And he looked at me and he said, but it would be a benevolent king. And it got to me ever since then. That was 8 years ago. And I've never stopped thinking about that. I'm going to have a king. Now, everybody just seems to jump right to, and that's going to be Jesus, and which is true, and that's amazing, and that's incredibly cool, and I can't wait. But I've never had a king before. I don't really know how to behave with a king. I have a president that I complain about, and I don't have to agree with, and I argue with people about which system he should be in. I haven't had a king. So my thoughts about this Davidic covenant and the coming king, which is amazing, and I can't wait, and it's such an incredible thing that's going to happen. A king is a weird thing. And for me, it's helpful to be thinking about what that might be like, and especially in that place. In a Jewish society with a Jewish king in a Jewish place in a Jewish world, that's my king. I should become familiar with that, I think. The new covenant, the last of the covenants that I want to talk about anyway. Again, this is, I'm sure, quite familiar to you. And in fact, Jack will be talking about it, I think, next week. Jeremiah 31, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Not like the covenant which I made with their fathers in the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, my covenant which they broke, although I was a husband to them, declares the Lord. But this is the covenant which I will make with the house of Israel. After those days, declares the Lord, I will put my law within them, and on their heart I will write it, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall not teach again each man his neighbor, and each man his brother, saying, know the Lord, for they shall all know me. From the least of them to the greatest of them, declares the Lord, I will forgive their iniquity, and their sin I will remember no more. I don't know if you've ever read this part of the newer covenant, as one man that I happen to listen to from time to time calls it. This is in Jeremiah later on in 31. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when the city shall be rebuilt for the Lord. We have another literal, physical, tangible explanation and description of what it is that's coming, where I am going to live, and I think you are too. This is fascinating. He says, this is the city which be rebuilt for the Lord from the tower of Hanel, or Hananel, to the corner gate, and the measuring line will go out further straight ahead to the hill of Gareb, and then will turn to Goa. I'm going to make sense of all this for you. And the whole valley of the dead bodies and of the ashes and of all the fields as far as the brook Kidron to the corner of the horse gate toward the east shall be holy to the Lord and shall not be plucked up or overthrown any more forever. Now, I have a super fancy map, but if I were smart enough to use one of those things, I would have written it up there, but I'm not. But if you were to draw the line, some of this stuff is ancient and they don't know exactly, but what Jeremiah just did in the New Covenant description just drew a line around Temple Mount. He started about where the Damascus Gate is right now. Some of you who have been there know exactly where I'm talking about. He goes to the west, down around to the corner gate, down along the western side, somewhere around the Jaffa Gate, past that, to something called the Hill of Gareb. That's what they don't know exactly where that is. But somewhere down in the southwest corner of Temple Mount, a little bit beyond that. Then he takes a turn to the east, down by the Dung Gate, up then on the east side, and again, those of you who have been there know what I'm talking about, the Kidron Valley, that ditch between Temple Mount and the Mount of Olives that we talked about earlier. That's what he just described. That's in the New Covenant, which I'd never seen before. Now, again, there's people smarter than I can make an argument that would say, well, he's not actually being literal about that, and here's why, and maybe they're right. But my take and my read right now is, that's pretty literal. That's pretty exact. That's pretty specific. That seems like what, in this case, Jeremiah is talking about that's coming when he is reestablishing Israel as his people. And remember, he's reestablishing me and you with them. So that's my digs. That's where I'll be. That's where I'll see, I'm going to argue in a minute, a temple. That's where I'll see a king on a throne. is in that place. So for me, again, I don't have to obsess about Israel. I don't have to obsess about Temple Mount. I don't have to know all those things. I don't have to have walked along the ramparts. But you know what? That I have makes that incredibly important to me. And I can't quite get over it. To think about what that means there as a believer today has an intrinsic value that I don't even know how to ascribe. But my point here is he speaks specifically about something that is over there now and will be later and will be rebuilt, which is what's coming next. Before there, I want to talk for a minute about the restoration of Israel as a country. I'm sure you all know the story, and it is a miraculous story, but I wonder if you've read the parts of Ezekiel where Ezekiel speaks. It sounds like, would that be 30, several millennia ago? Get my math completely wrong here. But let me just read this to you. And as you're listening to this, you should be thinking about what happened in 1948, approximately. It happened exactly in 1948, but the process that happened. As I live, declares the Lord, surely with a mighty hand and with an outstretched arm and the wrath poured out, I will be king over you. And I shall bring you out. Put some context here just before we go here. Remember that Israel had been sacked. The northern tribes had been taken by Assyria. The southern tribes by Babylon, Babylonians. And they're in a diaspora. They're not in Israel. They're somewhere else. So Ezekiel is prophesying into that. And he's arguing that something big is going to happen and they'll all be coming back. Now, I'm just going to tell you in advance, I already know that under the Persian kings, Ezra and Nehemiah and Zerubbabel and a bunch of people came back and there was a rebuilding that went on. I know that. I don't think that's what this is describing. A part of it is, there certainly was an important event that occurred, but not exactly like what we read here. And I shall bring you out from the peoples and gather you from the lands where you were scattered with a mighty hand and with an outstretched arm and with the wrath poured out. And I shall bring you into the wilderness of the peoples, and there I shall enter into judgment with you face to face. As I entered into judgment with your fathers in the wilderness in the land of Egypt, so I will enter into judgment with you, declares the Lord God. And I shall make you pass under the rod, and I shall bring you into the bond of the covenant. And I shall purge from you the rebels and those who transgress me. I shall bring them out of the land where they sojourn, but they will not enter the land of Israel. Thus you will know that I am the Lord. As for you, O house of Israel, thus says the Lord God, go, serve everyone his idols, but later you will surely listen to me and my holy name, and you will profane no longer with your gifts and with your idols. For on my holy mountain, on the high mountain of Israel, declares the Lord God, there the whole house of Israel, all of them, he writes, will serve me. They will serve me in the land. There I shall accept them. And there I shall seek your contributions and the choices of your gifts and all your holy things. As a soothing aroma, I shall accept you when I bring you out from the people and gather you from the lands where you are scattered, and I shall prove myself holy among you in the sight of the nations. And you will know that I am the Lord when I bring you into the land of Israel, into the land which I swore to give to your forefathers. And there you will remember your ways and all your deeds with which you have defiled yourselves, and you will loathe yourselves in your own sight for all the evil things that you have done. Then you will know that I am the Lord when I have dealt with you for my name's sake, not according to your evil ways or according to your corrupt deeds, O house of Israel, declares the Lord God. Two more passages here. I just think this is incredible. For thus says the Lord God, behold, I myself will search for my sheep and will seek them out as a shepherd. And remember, just think of yourself, what happened about 60 years ago or so. As a shepherd cares for his herd in the day when he is among the scattered sheep, so I will care for my sheep and I will deliver them from all the places by which they were scattered on a cloudy and gloomy day. For I will bring them out from the peoples and gather them from the countries, and I will bring them into their own land, and I will feed them on the mountains of Israel and by the streams and in the inhabited places of the lands. I will feed them in a good pasture, for their grazing ground will feed and will be on the mountain heights of Israel. There they will lie down in good grazing ground, and they will feed in the rich pasture on the mountains of Israel. I will feed my flock, and I will lead them to rest, declares the Lord. And then I won't read this passage in Ezekiel 37, where the valley of the dry bones, when God is speaking to Ezekiel, and he says, look at this death and destruction. I'm going to raise it up where it was once dead. I'll raise up. The bones will have flesh on them and ligaments on them, and they'll walk and move and live again. Now, again, does the restoration of Israel as a country, the declaration in 1947 when the UN said they could be a country again and gave them land, or at least part of the land, and in 48 in May when they declared themselves a sovereign nation, does that fulfill this prophecy? Well, I don't know if this is exactly what fills this prophecy, but sure is a good start. And I understand that after Ezekiel prophesied this, there was a movement back into Israel, but it didn't last. They all left again, and they certainly didn't become a country, and they weren't sovereign. But in 1948, that did happen. They did come back. They are sovereign, and it appears that they are there to stay. We'll see about that. So that's the restoration of Israel. That's the sixth reason why it is that I think Israel matters today. Three more things, and I'll finish up. The rebuilding of the temple. I'm going to go to Ezekiel here. Now, I think actually David and I have had this conversation as to whether or not the Ezekiel is actually predicting that this is going to be a temple rebuilt, like actually rebuilt or not. I think it is. He gets so specific, so exact about what it is that he is saying is going to happen. So let me just read this here. This is just one small section out of Ezekiel 43. Then he led me up to the gate, and the gate facing towards the east, and behold, the glory of the Lord of Israel was coming from the way of the east. For those of you who have been there, picture yourself, you're on Temple Mount, you're on the eastern side, you're looking to the east across the Mount of Olives, and this is allegedly where Jesus comes, the king rides in. I don't know if that's exactly how it goes down. Sounds a lot like it, though. And his voice was like that of the sound of many waters, and the earth shone with his glory, and it was like an appearance of the vision which I saw, like the vision which I saw when he came to destroy the city, and the visions were like the vision which I saw by the river Chebar. And I fell on my face, and the glory of the Lord came into the house by the way of the gate facing towards the east. And the Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner court, and behold, the glory of the Lord filled the house. And then I heard one speaking to me from the house while a man was standing beside me. And he said to me, Son of man, this is the place of my throne and the place of my soles of my feet, and I will dwell among the sons of Israel forever. And the house of Israel will not again defile my holy name, neither they nor their kings, by their harlotry and by the corpses of their kings when they die, and by setting their threshold of my threshold and on their doorpost beside them. He goes on and on and on to describe a very specific building in which the king, I think that's Jesus, is going to live. Now, let's just say for the sake of argument that that's actually going to happen. Well, that's a little bit of a problem on a number of fronts. But the biggest problem is a funny little place called the Mosque of Omar. Al-Aqsa Mosque doesn't help either, but right exactly where this temple is going to be rebuilt happens to be a mosque. That's fascinating to me. If this is right, well, not if this is right, if my interpretation of this is right, and a temple is coming to that place, then something's got to happen over there that hasn't happened yet. And how I think about that, and how I watch that, and frankly, the views that I develop about what's happening over there, I think this actually matters. I think this helps me frame what I should be thinking about the decisions and the way in which people are approaching that land. I'm not arguing that somebody should come bomb. I'm not saying any of those things. I'm just saying there's something there that won't be there anymore, and something's got to happen in order to allow this to occur. I care. As a believer who I think my king is going to set up camp on that hill in this building, I care. I want to know what they're thinking and why they're thinking it. I want to know about what's being dug underneath. I want to know about what they found. I want to know about what they're arguing about, what can and cannot happen on top of that mountain. I want to know who is and isn't allowed to be up there. I want to know what they will and they won't let me say when I'm up on top of there. I want to know all that stuff. Because at the end, when this is all said and done, that's my hill. I get to be there with my king. And for that reason, I care what happens there today. End times prophecy, eighth reason why Israel matters. I don't know anything about any of that stuff. I just don't. But I have read those books that Jack talked about by Joel Richardson. And I think he makes a very compelling case. And whether he's right or not, I don't know. But what I have decided is this. However the end times go down, and whoever it is that's the fourth beast and all that stuff, what I know for sure is that's not happening here, and it's not happening in Europe, and it's not happening anywhere except in Israel. And so as those things begin to unfold, however they do, and as I'm looking over to that section of the world, I'm paying very close attention because as I watch there, I find my scripture unfolding right before my very eyes, and that gives me a tremendous amount of confidence that what these promises are that God has given to his people, me, are actually coming true. I'm watching it unfold. So I'm watching carefully. I'm paying attention. I care about whether or not, well, if Richardson is right or others, I care about what's happening in the lives and the minds and the hearts of those people in Israel and the world in which we live that's coming down and trying to destroy that country. That matters to me because I think that all plays a part in how the whole thing comes to an end. So I pay attention. The last two things, and then I'm going to close. The last two things, why I care about Israel. This is a little weird, but and I've heard many people here say this. The more I see about what's happening over there, the less I think what's happening here matters. Especially right now, again, I'm not going to get into the politics, but it is fascinating to watch everything elevate there and everything, what's the opposite of elevate? Deflate here. We don't matter. Just don't. We're not playing a role. We're not playing a part. And that's just evident by what's going on around us. That doesn't make me not care about my country. And Susie and I watch the news every single night, all night, because of the dang elections. But so I care and I'm paying attention. But ultimately, I'm surprised how much this place doesn't matter and how much that place does. I care. It matters. It's important to me. And the last thing, I wrote here, the unspeakable. I don't know what it is. I don't know why it is. And if you've been there, you know what I'm talking about. There is something there that you cannot help but walk on that ground and say to yourself, there's nothing in the world that matters more. There's no place in the world that matters more. And as much as it's true that it makes the Bible come alive, it does. It helps your understanding of the biblical text, it does. It puts into context so many things that are incredibly helpful in developing your theology and your whole worldview. But something else happens, and I don't know what that is, but all I can walk away from there thinking and saying and believing and wondering about is how do I get back and how do I soak up some more of this place? Because it matters. I care. I care a lot. When it pops up on the news, I'm all over it. I'm listening in those debates for somebody to say something about that place. And they won't. No, I'm not going there. I just find it an unspeakable reality that that place matters a lot today. The ground on which we are able to walk there today matters. Well, I have a list that covers all that again, but I'm going to skip it. That's good. Any questions at all or comments? Reasons why I've lost my mind?
I have a question. This is a very small part of what you were doing, but I've never actually heard someone express this particular way of thinking about it. So I was wondering if you were just speaking loosely or if this is actually how you're picturing it happening. You kept saying that Jerusalem was your city and you were going to live there. I had never quite pictured it like that. I had kind of pictured that the Jews were living in the land of Israel and the nations were around, and the picture of the nations streaming there, you know, so there would be visits there to see the king and all that stuff, but that the land would be there. So are you actually saying that you think you will be living there in that city?
No, it's funny you mentioned that, because I actually have gone back and forth on that very topic. I'm prone to hyperbole, I think is what it's, I think that's what it is. Part of me actually thinks that I will live there. Part of me thinks that that's where all the believers will end up in one sense. But then I think, well, wait a minute, that's not that big of a place and it's a lot of people. So it makes less sense to me that everybody's going to be there all the time. But it does seem like there's something about that physical location that as a believer becomes a part of me in a way that it's not a part of me today. And I don't know if that's if we make our three trips a year there for the festivals. We fly instead of hike on our donkeys, I guess. But
No airplanes.
No airplanes. We teleport. We're going to teleport. So yeah, I probably was speaking a little loosely, but I got to admit, there is a part of me, and I have absolutely no way to defend this, that part of me that feels like, no, I actually think that's where I'm going to live. Maybe it's because I kind of want to live there now, but yeah, I was probably speaking a little loosely there.
Well, it's no big deal. I was just curious. It was interesting.
But my point, as I think you know, is that obviously you can tell I have all kinds of angst. Okay, I'm going to make one political statement. That's all I'm going to make. Today, Donald Trump said they were interviewing him on one of the stations, and he said, you never said anything about Israel. Forget who it was. I love Israel. Israel's a great place. He said, whoever the interviewer says, but you said you were neutral on Israel. And he said, well, yeah, in order to make a deal, you have to be neutral. In order to make a great deal, That's what he said. In order to make a great deal, you got to be neutral. In order to, that's a strategy that you take in order to ultimately come to a solution. You can't take a side. That's what he said. And I call BS. You do too have to take a side, in my opinion, because I think there's a right answer, and it's not the one that everybody's looking at, in my opinion. So I get worked up about that ground, and especially when those of you who have been there know how crazy it is to think about dividing it up into what people are suggesting they should. And I think that's just wrong. And I haven't quite figured out what to do with how wide those boundaries are that I read. If you put all it together, that's a lot of ground that's not Israel today. And that's a big problem in this world. I mean, we're talking about Jordan, Iraq, Iran, probably Lebanon, Syria. Something tells me that wouldn't go over super good if they were suggesting that today. So I don't know what, I haven't figured out what to do with that. But I just don't know how you get around those descriptions. I don't know what you do with that.
Well, it's kind of a funny position to be in, to be not like the prodigal son who didn't want to come home until he had experienced enough of life outside of the house, but in a sense to be in the opposite position where you're a son and you recognize where your true house is, but they don't want you there yet.
Yeah.
You know? And so you're in an odd position of waiting until the true king comes back and finally sets his house in order and changes the hearts of those who have been in management while he's been away, such that you finally are welcome there.
Yeah.
Right. And that may not happen in our lifetime.
Yeah.
So I find there's a lot that you're saying that resonates with me. And yet at the same time, when I look at the people of Israel who are there now, and what a shadow of the nation that they will be one day.
Yeah.
There's a sadness.
Yeah.
That fills my heart because, well, of that position that you're in where you recognize yeah. that they should see me as a brother, and yet they don't. Right.
So no, they really don't.
Right. And so I don't know how you reconcile yourself with this present moment. I have a hard time with that other than simply to look at how God may be fulfilling his promises in his own time. And however I may be involved in that, that's to him. But
you said a number of super important things. The striking thing about Israel today is what a godless place it is today. I mean, it is amazing. And yet, godless as it is, there is that sense still that something is up. Something's happening. Something's going on. One of the interesting things, I don't know if any of these statistics are true. Maybe Adam can verify when he gets over there. But they say that a number of messianics in Israel are rising exponentially. And I've heard that many times. And I guess I don't know ever how you verify that or whatever. But it does seem as though there is something happening. I have absolutely no intention of talking about any of this stuff. But I do happen to think, personally, that one of the interesting things that has happened in our little community here, these notions about this humanity / divinity of Jesus, it does seem that there's something to that question that is part of what appears to be potentially something that can help that problem. As the church, generally speaking, and we've done such a horrible job of presenting who Jesus is, but as a real, if ever such a thing, as a real picture of who Jesus is, could ever be presented, it seems to me that there is a point at which that godlessness begins to shift at that moment, at that time. I mean, God's obviously going to do that whenever he decides to do it, and he can do it for any reason that he wants to do it. But I'm just, I guess, naive enough to think that there's actually something to what's happening right now. And I bet you that centuries of people have been saying this very thing. It seems like it's right now. It's just around the corner. But I actually feel like that. But you're so right. There's this huge pushback, and yet you can't help but go, but this is the spot, and this is the place. Yeah.
Talking about the third building of the temple, before Christ or after he comes back?
Well, that passage that I am about as far away as you can get to be an expert on this, but that passage, it sounds like that temple's there and the Lord comes. Now, the question is the whole meeting in the sky, has that happened already? I don't know how the timeline is, but I feel like it's the temple gets built and then the Lord returns, but I don't know.
It seems from things that I've heard that they've prepared everything they need for the temple. They just don't have the building.
Yes. In fact, you might have met the man, the fiery red-haired guy. What's the name of that third temple? You remember? Third temple. There's an institute there, and they have built, at least I've read from them, they have 100% of the temple implements built and stored. They even say they've got the red heifer. They even, and I actually just read this recently, where they have all the priestly clothes made, but all they lack is the building. And again, I'm trying to be pretty careful there because I realize that I don't know if there's really going to be a temple or not. I mean, but it sure seems like it, and they sure think there's going to be. No doubt about that.
When you've talked a lot about your feelings and your belief meshed together.
Yeah.
And when you stand on the Mount of Olives and you hear in my mind and in my heart the abomination of that call to prayer that echoes all over, you have to feel that that's going to be erased.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, yes. So most of you probably know this, but five times a day? I can't remember. Five times a day, from the minarets that are scattered all over the place, but in Jerusalem as well, the little guy hikes up there and he chants his call to prayer for the Muslims, and you can hear it. Maybe I've told you the story, but when we were there, we were on the temple steps, and I was actually speaking. You guys remember this. And I was in the middle of saying something, and then the call to prayer went on. And Abraham stood up and turned around, and he screamed at the top of his lungs, "Shut up!" Shook his head. Yeah, I have visceral response to that myself. Yeah.
Well, if we think of Christ's return to establish his kingdom, what we call a millennial kingdom, referred to, if that's our stance, it would be no problem for him to establish his kingdom throughout the entire promised land, I would think. And
you mean to the borders that...
Yes.
Yeah, right.
And beyond.
Right.
The whole earth, I would guess.
Right.
Yeah, it just seems like that view would solve a lot of the issues that you're speaking to as far as that Dome of the Rock, all that being rebuilt into a temple. I don't have a stance. I used to... That was my stance because that was what I was taught in dispensational teaching. But as far as the temple being rebuilt before his return, I don't know about that as far as scripture supporting that. It sounds like people are trying to make it happen.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, I could be wrong about this, but I believe the Orthodox view is it is the rebuilding of the temple that will bring the Messiah, I think. Anybody know? I think that's right. I think they're actually trying to lure him in with the temple.
Does that work?
We're going to find out, I bet. So, that stuff, I don't know the timing of that. I mean, I just don't know.
Yeah, if that's in God's timing, I don't know that man would have an effect on him returning, unless it was circumstance.
I'm totally with you on the he can do it and will do it however he wants, and that's exactly how it's going to go. But you just have, to even utter a word like from here to there to here to there is the border. If it's outside of the current Israeli lines, it's anathema. Mm-hmm. Never mind adding anybody else's ground, Muslim ground. I mean, it's unthinkable. That's what makes it, to me, so amazing.
Well, if we were to be raptured and return with him to reign in Jerusalem, that's how we would be there.
Yeah, on my hill.
Yes.
Right.
Unless we're this big. Then everybody would fit.
We might be really, really little when we come back. I never thought about that. That's a good point.
I have a question. So how does the idea that God's going to create a new earth work with your ideas of...
How does he what? I'm sorry.
How does the idea that God is going to eventually create a new heavens and a new earth...
Yeah.
This is a really basic question.
Yeah.
I haven't thought about some of these things before. And so how does that idea kind of sit with your more precise ideas of location and things coming down?
Yeah, that's maybe the only one thing that I do feel like I have some sense of, like, this is probably how this is going to go down. The timing of the temple and the Lord's return and all that stuff, it does seem like there is... However long this millennial reign really is, if it's 1,000 years or 100 years or 5 minutes, at the end of some time when Jesus is actually doing his thing on earth, and however that all goes, that comes to an end, and there appears, it seems to me, a recreated earth at that moment in time, and that's how I deal with it. At the end of all of that, that's when he redoes the thing completely. So does that make sense? So temple built, Lord returns, He's on his throne. Believers are doing their thing. Maybe non-believers are having another opportunity to listen. And I don't know how any of that goes, but it goes. That comes to an end, and God redoes everything.
And he redoes everything, and so...
into a new heaven and a new earth.
And so your thoughts about eternity, of spending eternity, like...
I think it's here, if that's what you're asking. The new heaven and the new earth, I think he does it right here, and it's a totally different place, though, than where we live today. So maybe I'm not catching your question.
And what about Israel? So I heard you say earlier that you, and maybe I misunderstood you, that you were thinking and hoping... and like the idea of, but not totally clear on, spending eternity in Israel.
Yeah.
Okay. So.
I think this is getting to where Ron was. Do I really mean that I'm personally going to be in Israel forever and ever and ever? No, I don't think I do mean that. But what I do think happens is the forever and the eternity is real, but it does change in its physical structure at some point in time, but it doesn't become any less forever. Does that make sense? So I am going to be in a place or on a place that is temporary, but my position before God and the reality that I will live in is forever. He's just going to shift and redo everything sometime in the middle there, but it won't make anything less of my forever and eternity that I read here.
I think I'm following you.
Okay.
Does Jerusalem, is it Jerusalem in both places?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, does that help?
Yes.
Yeah.
So the new place.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that is what he calls the new Jerusalem.
Before and after.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Otherwise, I was going to say, I think I need somebody to draw it out for me.
Yeah.
But thank you. I think that's what I was getting at, but didn't know it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Question is the ground under our feet as immortal as we are in the forever? Is that the question? Because if God grants the chosen immortality, they shall never die.
Right.
Okay. But it sounds like the earth does.
Yeah.
But the new one won't.
Yeah. That's how I would see it.
So the ground we walk on, the steps up to the temple, will get a nice deep groove in them over the thousands and thousands of years. By the way, I've seen steps like that. It's a wonderful feeling.
Yeah.
You know, it's like how many tens of thousands of steps have worn this groove. But will there be maintenance? Well, a step's about to break. We should probably... build a new one. But you're saying that the new heavens and the new earth is not just the new land, like a new space on this earth, but an actually new planet. A planet without fault, without risk, without an expiration date.
In what's called the new heaven and the new earth. Yeah, I do. That's what
and
I think.
Apparently so will we.
Yeah.
But there will be a new Jerusalem.
Well, I think so. But I think part of this is, this sounds like a total cop-out, but it's true. So much of that stuff seems so unclear to me. I mean, when he says a new Jerusalem, there will be one, so there is another Jerusalem. But what does he mean by new Jerusalem? Does he mean a new chunk of ground in the Middle East that gets raised like it is? I don't know. But it will be, I think that you described it very well, a new planet that he calls the new Jerusalem.
And the new Jerusalem will have been made without human hands.
Yeah.
It says. So what we're basically have a new capital city made for him, that his followers get to serve him in.
Yeah.
But where's the race of beings making it right now?
Yeah. I don't know. We're late, so we should go. Thank you very much.